Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning, first of all, to Luke 22. The political circumstances in the first century in Israel, or Judah as it was called then, are very similar to what we find in the United States today. Senatus Populusque Romanus was in charge of most of the known world from the English Channel all the way to the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It was ruled originally as a republic, and finally as an empire under Caesars. They worshipped idols. Yet at the same time, they provided an environment in which Paul called the fullness of time. The moment in history when God chose to allow His Messiah to come into human history in hypostatic union. The Jews were ensconced within the Roman Empire as a province. The province of Palestine, and it was broken down into three tetrarchs, one of which was Judah. And Judah, of course, housed primarily all of the religious paraphernalia, all of the religious leadership for Judaism. And these people worshipped in the temple in Jerusalem, and they were led by a Jewish hierarchy made up of representatives of the Sanhedrin headed by a high priest. These people were allowed to rule themselves to a certain degree. The Roman Empire did not care about their religion, but they didn't mind that they exercised it. Yet the Jews were not in charge of anything. The Romans were. And the Jews hated the Romans because they wanted to be in charge of everything. And they believed that at any moment their Messiah would arrive into human history and get rid of Roman oppression. And today we have very similar circumstances in our country. We, the United States of America, have provided an environment of freedom where a person can have free exercise of his religion as long as they do not bother the government in its various exercises. But there are many who want to take over the government so that they can execute their religious ideals at the expense of the majority. This is the heresy that was in the minds of those who were in charge of the Jewish religion in the first century. They wanted to be in charge, and they visioned a Messiah that would come and lead them to this wonderful higher ground. The Romans, of course, had nothing on their minds, and they therefore were protecting their authority and their regime. Today, we will note in our society that there are certain aspects of religious outspeaking that desire to bring down the majority government and to replace it with their ideas of how things ought to be. I think that as we go through our study today, you can see some correlations. The title of it is What is Truth? Or Pontius Pilate's Fatal Question. The nomen Pontius is Pontius, the second of the three usual names of a Roman male. It indicates the stock or family name from which Pilate was descended. The cognomen, that would be Pilatus, the third of the three usual names of a Roman male. His prenomen, the first name of the three, is not known. It refers to the branch of the gens Pontius, in which Pilate belonged. And so he is known to biblical students as Pontius Pilate. And most biblical dictionaries assign him the title of procurator of the Roman province of Judea. He is known, therefore, as Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea. Well, a procurator was a Roman official who was superior to a prefect. It's important to get these titles. You You have a procurator and a prefect. And a procurator was a Roman official superior to a prefect and therefore a deputy of a provincial governor. So a governor would be over a procurator. And then under him would be a prefect. A prefect is a commander of auxiliary units, the praetorian guard, a citizen of equestrian status. Prefects also governed Egypt, and between the years AD 6 and AD 41, it was a prefect that ruled the province of Judea. Recent archaeological evidence reveals that the Roman authority over the province of Judea was not a procurator, but a prefect. The prefect over Judea served under the governor of Syria, who was based in Caesarea. Now, Pilate was the fifth Roman prefect of Judea. He was appointed in the year AD 26 by Emperor Tiberius to replace Valerius Gratus. The English New Testament translates the Greek word hegemon with the word governor to indicate Pontius Pilate's title. This is obviously confusing, so some explanation is needed. Before AD 53, those who governed the province of Judea were called prefects. After AD 53, they were called procurators. What added to the confusion is that the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus referred to the ruler of Judah as prefect, procurator, and governor. The prefects were of the second highest social class, called the equites or equestrians. This was a Roman order of knighthood, which required them to have a net worth of 400 sesterces. A sesterce was a quarter of a denarius, and therefore 400,000 of them would have been worth $20,000, a denarius worth 20 cents. Now, to put that in a pay scale of today, you would have a denarius worth 20 cents. That would be a day's wage in Rome. Today, you get $7 an hour for an eight-hour work day. If you multiply that out to 400,000 of these, you have $22.4 million. So, $20,000 equivalent in American currency was a lot in the first century. The definition, rank, and authority then of these titles are brought into focus by an archaeological discovery in Caesarea in 1961. For details, we turn to an excellent book by Stephen Dando Collins. His chapter, or actually his appendix, The Uniqueness of the Legion Commands in Egypt and Judea. They were unique because they were ruled by prefects, not procurators. There were only two places, Egypt and Judea. It comes from his excellent book, Caesar's Legions, and we note from page 277. During the reign of Augustus, that's the years 27 B.C. to A.D. 14, appointed officials of the equestrian order rank to govern Egypt and decreed that no Roman of senatorial rank could even enter the province of Egypt at any time, for any reason, without the emperor's specific permission. This was because, at the time, Egypt was considered to be the breadbasket of the empire, and therefore he who controlled the grain supply could control Rome. And to ensure that no senator ever thought about challenging the empire by taking a revolutionary road via Egypt, it was off limits. For this reason, the governor of Egypt was always a prefect, a commander of the Praetorian Guard, and therefore a rank that we would call colonel. An officer of the equestrian rank, never of consular or senatorial rank, as in other important provinces. He was also paid as much as a top proconsul to maintain his loyalty and his incorruptibility. Yet there were always legions, soldiers, in Egypt. Imperial legions were ordinarily commanded by legates. These are legion commanders that would have a rank in our society and in our military of a brigadier general. They were officers of a senatorial rank, and therefore if legates had commanded legions in Egypt, their presence would have contravened the law of Augustus that forbade a senatorial rank to be in country. Tacitus, A.D. 56 to 120, a Roman orator, politician, and historian, confirms that from the time of Augustus, Rome's armed forces in Egypt were always commanded by knights of the equestrian order, therefore by colonels, not by generals. So a unique but simple solution was arrived at to solve the Egyptian dilemma. A precedent was set regarding the command of the legions in Egypt. In deference to the Augustan law, legions stationed in Egypt were commanded by their second in command, a senior tribune, who also had colonel rank, an officer of the equestrian order, and these officers were subordinate to the prefect of Egypt, also a colonel, but one who outranked them in the equestrian order seniority. A similar situation existed regarding the garrison in Judea. One or two writers have put forward the theory that no legion could have been stationed in Judea prior to A.D. 70, and the province could only have been garrisoned by auxiliaries. These are non-citizens serving in the Roman army. They're paid less than a legionary. They're granted citizenship, but on discharge. And this was true because the governor of the province was merely a procurator, superior to a prefect and a deputy to the provincial governor, and he would have had general rank. Therefore, a legate commanding a legion in this province would have outranked him, and therefore it was an unacceptable situation. Now, as it happens, the administrator of Judea until the reign of Claudius in AD 41 was not a procurator at all, but a prefect. Pontius Pilate, celebrated famously in countless books and films and television programs as Pilate, the procurator of Judea, similarly held the appointment as prefect of Judea, not procurator. A fact confirmed by an inscription relating to Pilate found at Caesarea in 1961. And in the same way that the prefect of Egypt could command legions stationed in his province because they were led by their senior tribunes, so the prefect of Judea could command legionary forces in his province. Now there is ample evidence that legions were stationed in Judea during this period. Verus, the Roman general and consul, governor of Syria, stationed a legion, the 10th, in Jerusalem in 4 B.C. The Jewish historian Josephus several times writes of legionaries of the Judea garrison in years leading up to the first Jewish revolt in A.D. 66 through 70 and provides plenty of clues about the identity of the legion stationed in the province between A.D. 48 and 66. They were called the Augustans, the Syrians, and the men from Beirut. For us to know that it was the 3rd Augusta, a Syrian legion with a major recruitment station in Beirut. The fact that elements of the 3rd Augusta legion were stationed at Jerusalem and at Caesarea is confirmed by the Christian Bible in Acts 27, verse 1. When it was decided we would sail to Italy, they handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion, which would be a first lieutenant, of the Augustan cohort. That would be a commander of 100 legionaries of the 3rd Augusta. And his name was Julius. Acts 27:1. This talks of men, therefore, the Augustan legion saving and escorting St. Paul the Apostle in AD 58 through 61. There were 3 Augustan legions, and the 2nd Augusta and the 8th Augusta were never stationed in the east, but the 3rd was. There is never a mention of a general or a legate commanding the legion stationed in Judea prior to A.D. 70. The conclusion that can be drawn is that in A.D. 70, Judea was treated in the same way as Egypt. The officer commanding the legion based in the province was its senior tribune, a colonel. And normally the legion's second in command, who would have been outranked by a prefect, also a colonel, but with seniority, and could therefore take orders from him. As with the legions in Egypt, when the Judea legion left the province, a legate or a brigadier general could be appointed to command it. Now, in the author's note preceding the first chapter of his book, Dando Collins makes this observation. Enough material exists from sources classical and modern to write whole books of the Third Augusta, the legion that saved the life of St. Paul the Apostle. It was this legion that Pontius Pilate commanded as a prefect. Consequently, we're able to conclude then that Pontius Pilate was not a procurator, but rather a prefect, which may be compared to the rank of colonel in the United States Army. He was thus supervised by two men whose headquarters were in Caesarea, the provincial governor or legate, and his deputy who did hold the title of procurator, neither of whom is mentioned in Scripture by name or by deed. We never hear of these guys up in Caesarea. There's some indication that the offices were not even being held at that time of Roman history. Now, as prefect, Pontius Pilate was commander of the Praetorian Guard and governed the province of Judea. To him was delegated the power of life and death. He was appointed to his position by Lucius Aelius Sejanus, Emperor Tiberius' chief administrator. Sejanus influenced Tiberius to retire to the island of Capri in the Tyrrhenian Sea and to leave him in charge of the empire. Pilate disliked the Jews and did many things to intimidate them, but when they complained to Rome, Sejanus protected Pilate, and Pilate was dependent upon Sejanus. I might also say that it was Sejanus who performed the political necessities to have Pontius Pilate assigned to the province of Judea as prefect. With all of this background in mind, we now want to take up the six trials of Christ, although today we're only going to look at two. We're going to look at two in which Pontius Pilate is involved, plus another that leads up to the first trial. The third trial of Christ, therefore, is some background. By the time Jesus arrived at Pilate's official residence, a palace referred to by the Romans as the Praetorium, he had already faced three trials. The third had been before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a compound of sun, which means together, and the noun hedra, which means to be seated, and therefore to be seated together in council is the idea of the Sanhedrin. As far back as the 3rd century B.C., it was referred to as the Garisia, which is Greek for Senate or Elders. Now, the Sanhedrin was composed of 70 members made up of the high priest. It also included tribal heads called elders. There were scribes who were experts in the law, and of course, the ever-present Pharisees and Sadducees. Its jurisdiction was limited to the province of Judea, and therefore it had no legal authority over Jesus as long as he stayed in the province of Galilee. Within Judea, the Sanhedrin had legal authority over the Jewish community that was not reserved for the prefect himself. Therefore, Pontius Pilate stayed out of Jewish affairs until certain circumstances that came under his aegis arose. The Jews could come to him for assistance, but otherwise he left them alone as long as they minded their manners. Now, the first two trials were conducted in the residences of Annas, the high priest emeritus, and his son-in-law Caiaphas, the current high priest, respectively. And these trials were conducted at night, and that violated Jewish law. Therefore, a third trial took place after sunrise at the Sanhedrin in order for the conviction of Jesus to comply with Jewish laws. Now, had word gotten back to Pilate that the Jews were involved in this miscarriage of justice, members of the Sanhedrin could have come under Roman investigation. It is interesting that the whole sequence of events is designed to rid them of Jesus this assumed Messiah from their view, to get rid of him so they could then carry out the Passover, which taught of him. They were trying to get rid of the true Passover so they could observe the Passover. And therefore, they're willing to break Mosaic law in order to speed his trials, in order to get rid of him so they can get away from the reality and back to the ritual. Expediency, therefore, demanded prudence, and this required the daylight trial before the entire assembly of the Sanhedrin's membership. For this, we go to Luke 22, beginning at verse 66. And as day dawned, the ruling elders of the people, both priests and scribes, were brought together at the Sanhedrin, saying, if, and that's a first-class condition, and for the sake of debate, we assume that you are, that's what it says here, if you are Messiah, tell us. But he said to them, if, a third-class condition, if I told you, you would not believe me. And a third-class condition says, maybe you will, maybe you won't. In this case, you won't believe me. And if, third-class condition, you ask, you will not answer. Now the Lord's response to the council indicates His understanding of their rejection of His true identity. If He did tell them who He was, they would not believe it. And if He asked them who He was, they would not respond correctly. He completely understood the disposition of those who were interrogating Him. And to emphasize who He claims to be, He continues. Verse 69. But in the future, the Son of Man will be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. He has asserted that He is Messiah. And He takes them back to Psalm 110, verse 1. He says that in the future the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of God. It is a statement where He proclaims Himself to be Messiah. We find in that Psalm's passage that the Father instructs David's greater son, which is the Messiah, to, quote, sit down at my right hand. And this is a strong affirmation not only of deity, but also of messiahship. And for him to quote that verse in the midst of this interrogation is an absolute proclamation that he is the Messiah. So in verse 70, then they all said, you then are the Son of God. And he said to them, you say that I am. In the idiom of the day, Jesus confirms their question. He allows their accusation to stand as an affirmation of His true identity. And to the council's prejudiced ear, the Lord's affirmation is regarded as a condemnation. Verse 22:71, and they said, why do we need any more testimony? We ourselves have heard it from His own mouth. Now, He's told them the truth. The interesting part about this is He told the truth. They asked Him who He was. He told them the truth. And they decided that He has confessed to blasphemy. It was the third trial. The first two were illegal. The third one is a show trial in order to comply with the law. If Pilate gets wind, they tried him at night, then they will be under investigation. And now they come to Him with questions that seek from Him a testimony as to who He is, and He tells them the truth, and they accuse Him of blasphemy. Well, the prosecution now rests with a verdict of blasphemy. It is a capital crime under Jewish law, but the Jews don't have the authority to execute anyone. They want to kill Him, but they don't have the authority, and they're running out of time. Passover only kicks off an 8-day ritual and festival. It's Passover followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which lasts an entire week. We can't have this criminal hanging around, rousing the rabble for 8 solid days, interrupting the most important entire feast day that we have. So what are we going to do? We're running out of time. The desire to neutralize the troublemaker as quickly as possible, but Roman law prohibiting them from officially inflicting capital punishment caused them to then turn to Pilate. Some note to the contrary that it wasn't necessarily against Roman law by bringing up the assassination of Stephen, who was stoned to death by the Jews. But this really was something that was ignored by the Roman officials. It was something that was a religious problem that the Jews had handled. They allowed it to be covered up. There's no other indication anywhere that the Jews had the authority of capital punishment. And although they carried it out on occasion, doesn't mean that they had the authority to do so. Now, unable to carry out the execution at this point, and of course they couldn't do it with a figure as public as Jesus of Nazareth had become, the Sanhedrin adjourned. And then they transferred the prisoner over to the headquarters of the prefect Pontius Pilate. Now get this, it's early in the morning, and Pontius Pilate is over at the praetorium. He's already had his breakfast. People in that day and age got up early in the morning. They got up as soon as day would break. They opened their shops along the thoroughfares of Jerusalem and began business. Only the extremely wealthy would sleep as late as 7 o'clock in the morning. Pontius Pilate was a government official, and he always rose early and had his breakfast. He adjudicated cases there in the praetorium, and this day was no exception. He had people coming into the court of the praetorium seeking certain forms of litigation or trying to receive some form of justice. This is what was going on at Pontius Pilate's palace when the Jews hauled Jesus in for the special hearing. We now move for the fourth trial of Christ to John 18, verse 28. And verse 28 reads this way. Then they brought Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. Now it was very early in the morning. They did not enter the praetorium in order that they might not be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. They've got the Passover with them, and they don't want to go inside the praetorium because they'll be defiled and can't eat the Passover. The praetorium, therefore, was the temporary residence of the governor of Syria, whose permanent residence was up in Caesarea. When he came into the province of Judea, that is where he stayed. It was the permanent residence of the prefect, who at this time was Pontius Pilate. Since this was the residence of a Gentile, the Jewish authorities refused to enter, since to do so would render them defiled and thus disqualify them from eating that evening's Passover Seder. They've got the Passover with them, and they do not want to defile themselves so they can't eat the ritual. The refusal of Jewish leadership to accept Jesus as their Messiah is therefore expressed by this verse. They wanted to expedite the slaying of Jesus, their true Passover, so that they might be ceremonially clean to eat the ritual Passover that evening. Therefore, for them, ritual trumped reality. Ritual is designed to teach about the reality, yet the Jews place primary emphasis on the ritual, thus assuming God is more impressed with ritual of Passover than reality of Passover. And they rejected the love of God through Jesus the Christ, who died spiritual death on Calvary's cross for their sins. Now this contrast between ritual and reality is expressed by the Lord in John 3:36, and I offer a paraphrase. He who believes in the reality has eternal life. He who believes in the ritual shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. And so in verse 39 of John 18, so Pilate came outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They came to the entrance of the praetorium, and some members of the praetorian guard were there, and they requested Pontius Pilate to appear to them. How arrogant. He's the prefect. They've come to his house. They want him to come out into the front yard and meet with him. And so a messenger has to be sent inside, interrupting the proceedings that Pontius Pilate now has underway. He's performing judicial acts based on those who appear and the order they arrived at the praetorium. These are people of the Roman community. They are coming in to carry out business of the day that requires judgment from Pontius Pilate in some manner or fashion. He's got a sequence of events going on. It's organized. People arrive, they take a number, they get in line. These Jews show up, they won't even come inside, they won't even take a number, they want him outside, and they want him to come out now. And so what does Pontius Pilate do? He goes outside. He stops what he's doing. He goes outside, interrupting his proceedings to meet with these Jews. What does that say about Pontius Pilate? Something's going on in this man's mind to cause him to stop what he's doing, prefect of Judea, and go outside and meet with a bunch of rabble in his mind. Why would he do that? On this occasion, Pilate was involved in the judgment of cases brought before him by litigants throughout the province of Judea. He heard the arguments and the order they arrived at the praetorium. And these adjudications were taking place as usual in the palace's inner court when the Jewish throng arrived at the entrance to the palace demanding this audience with Pilate. Pilate's decision to concede to the religious demands of Jewish leadership was the catalyst of the most significant sequence of events in all of human history. Had he demanded that the Jews disband and go through proper channels, chances are that things might have turned out quite differently. But such is iffy history. And what really happened was Pilate being victimized by Alinsky tactics. The rabble were in essence saying this: if we don't get our way, we will demonstrate. And the demonstration might very well turn into a riot. And you surely don't want Tiberius to get wind of an uprising in Judea, do you? There are a lot of things that go around that concept. Pontius Pilate is in big trouble. A concept we'll note in our second session. But the political landscape has changed in Rome. And at the time that our Lord is brought before him, for this first trial before him, he has lost his influence in Rome, and he is scared to death of Tiberius. And therefore, when he heard that these Jews were gathering at his palace door, and they wanted him to come outside and meet them, it is obvious that one of the guards had reported that these people are angry, they're upset, they have a large group with them, and they plan to do damage if we don't quell this. He could not allow a riot to break out in Jerusalem during a time of Passover where people from all over the empire, Jews of course, had come in for the celebration. Anything erupts, it's going to get back to Tiberius. Now that sets the stage now for the continuation of our story. And it's time for tea and crumpets, so we'll begin at this point at about 10 till the hour.